What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, Christy Francesco. Joining me, George Rogers, Dean Holzapple. Hope you guys are doing well. This week, we are fresh off of our 1991 SummerSlam. So thank you to everybody who's been downloading that. Dean, you're on mute, by the way. So just want to let everybody know what's coming up real quick. Tonight we are covering SummerSlam 1997, and I called a little bit of an audible because I really wanted to cover another SummerSlam that I'm adding onto the docket here on the back end of this. One of my all-time favorite storylines and programs in my life watching wrestling was the 1994 SummerSlam, which was Undertaker versus The Undertaker. Obviously, when you look back 28 years, basically, it's hokey as shit and not good. But with me, when I was 8 years old, it was the coolest thing you'd ever seen. Two Undertakers, you don't know what they are, you know, who's who. It's, you know, kayfabe was at a peak at that point.
I knew.
Of course you did.
Well, I knew Taker was taller.
Well, I knew when the match started. Yeah. As soon as the match started, I kind of knew. But back then, it was still really cool. I mean, they actually did the story really well.
They did.
And I thought that it was well done. And I really want to cover that pay-per-view. We're going to do that on the back end of this whole SummerSlam rewind. But tonight.
Ooh, I like that. Kind of like WrestleMania Backlash.
That's right, yeah. Tonight we are going...
It's not as stupid.
We are going back in time here, 25 years. August 3rd, the Continental Airlines Arena in East Rutherford, New Jersey. SummerSlam. So just to get people up here on the buy rates for the show, you know, this is 1997. And as we've talked about before on this pod, you know, this is in the middle of, you know, the 83 weeks, as it were, where WCW was just smashing WWF and, you know, almost every metric other than maybe live gates and revenue. But in 1997, the only thing that mattered was television ratings. And, you know, this was before the Monday Night Wars, really. This is right before the WWF really kicked things into gear. And on this specific pay-per-view, the whole run of the Attitude Era almost came to a crashing halt. And we're going to definitely get into that. But here's a little numbers for this pay-per-view.
I say something real fast?
Yeah.
I don't mean to cut you off. I meant to say this to George, actually, we were watching it. this is very much to me, I feel like it's, you know, we're in that early stages of the Attitude Era. But it still feels like a nice... it's in that in between of like the very, 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 very dying embers of the New Generation era too. Like Vince is still on commentary. And they still got that classic SummerSlam logo and stuff like that. So, it was kind of nice to, revisit that kind of time period of the company. Cause, even though I do like the New Generation era a lot, I do block it out because it is my, you know, one of my least favorite eras at the same time, like compared to like, you know, Attitude Era and stuff like Golden Age.
Of course,
like, you know, it's not up there, but it's kind of cool to revisit it. I'm glad we did this one.
Yeah. The New Generation is basically the rebuilding stage. And from a sports term, it was the rebuilding stage of the company.
Yeah.
So 225,000 pay-per-view buys, which was the third highest of the year. Only Survivor Series and WrestleMania were higher. So this was a big one for the WWF at the time. 20,200 fans paid a live gate of $523,000, which was the second highest gate of the year. And 202,500 in merchandise, which was the highest of the entire 1997 pay-per-view calendar for the WWF. So a big night at the merch table, basically because this is the summer of 316, Austin 316. So the shirts, I'm willing to bet more than half of that number was Austin 316 t-shirts.
Oh yeah.
I mean, hands down. So quick little backstory here. Every member of the Hart Foundation on this show had a match that involved a stipulation. And, you know, we'll learn more about them as we get to that. The main one, of course, involved Bret Hart. Bret was a challenger to the Undertaker's world title. He claimed that if he didn't win the belt, he would never wrestle in the United States again, which is something that American fans adored at the time. Being that the show was in New Jersey, it would mean that the already favorite Undertaker would be even more beloved by the fans. Meanwhile, Shawn Michaels wasn't in the match for the show, so he asked to be the special guest referee. His wish was obviously granted, although he had to agree to a similar fate. If he did anything to cost Bret Hart the match, he would not be allowed to wrestle in America either. So stupid. The Hart-Michaels issue wasn't just something for the cameras at the time, which we all know by now. There was legit heat here, especially at this point. They had a pull-apart fight in the backstage area like 2 months before the show, where Michaels threatened to quit the company but ultimately stayed, although I think he missed like 3 to 4 weeks of TV after it. He also lost the tag belt he held with Steve Austin, who now had, you know, Dude Love or Mankind in this pay-per-view as his championship partner. There was a lot of questions going into the show about how Michaels and Hart would be able to work together in a major setting like this. It was the WWF's second biggest show of the year, and there's a lot of questions, both from a fan perspective and a company one. So there was just so much happening in this time period. The video package is in black and white, tells us how Bret Hart, The Undertaker, and Shawn Michaels have all their various problems going on, with Bret being hated by America, Undertaker being tormented by his past, and Michaels having a lot of problems with Bret Hart. Pretty cool video, I thought. I've always, you know, liked the voice of the guy they used back in those days. He did all of the pay-per-views, it felt like. The announcers here are a maniac, Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry Lawler. Vince McMahon, funny that Dean said this. What a maneuver! One, two, he got... No, he didn't. Funny thing that Dean mentioned this. Vince only commented, or play-by-play man, for two more pay-per-views after this before permanently becoming an on-air character. So this was nearing the end of Vince McMahon's time behind the desk. George, what was your thoughts? Did you enjoy Vince McMahon as a play-by-play guy?
Sorry, I was mid-yawn. Yes, okay. I was a big Vince fan. Mm-hmm. It was because of his style. It was, you know,
he the ultimate hype man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, he was making, you know, a mundane move to feel like the devastating thing in the world. You know, clothesline turn him inside out. It's like, well, not really. But, all right. I mean, if you're buying
he did that during the Owen match. When Owen and Austin traded sleeper holds, he was like, oh, here we go.
This is like,
they're sleeper holes.
Vince is the ultimate hype man, and him and King had such good chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell with them bringing in Jim Ross that it was really only a matter of time before Vince stepped away from the booth.
Yeah, it was always hilarious to me when with JR with Vince, because it was like the complete opposite sides of the spectrum. It was, you know, Vince McMahon saying, you know, that's Brian Pillman. He's a crazy guy in that ring. Yeah, well, there, Vince, that there, Brian Pillman, he played football at East Cincinnati High School. He's an athlete. That had nothing to do with the drop kick that he just did. Yeah. But it was always really funny.
He's a loose cannon, Brian Pillman, and then Jared's like, oh, he played for the Bengals.
Speaking of JR, not to deviate for a second, did you guys know that they have reduced his commentary time on AEW?
I think that was his call, wasn't it?
He only does the last hour of Dynamite.
Yeah.
So now he can be miserable for 1 hour a night.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough to hear him sometimes. Yeah.
I like how he keeps calling the AEW championship the WWE championship.
Oh, it's, God.
It's the funniest thing in the world.
Yeah, it really is. Anyway. So here we go. Opening match here, steel cage match, Hunter Hearst Helmsley with China versus Mankind. You guys might be surprised, but I actually gave this about a star and a half. I
well, don't get too generous.
Well, they did it. I just feel like they did not a great job at making this super exciting. I just felt like it was spot after spot with like no psychology involved, which was odd for Hunter Hearst Helmsley and even sometimes Mankind, as crazy and not a fan of Mick Foley as I am. He still was very good at telling a story because he was always good at getting a beat down then with a good comeback. But, you know, it wasn't all bad because Mick Foley was really taking off as a babyface at this point. And, you know, Hunter would soon become part of DX. I thought this was a good match in terms of furthering an angle. But as a match, you know, there was all big spots, but it was kind of a letdown. I guess I expected more. I mean, am I too off on that, George?
No, I mean, I enjoyed it for, you know, it was a cage match in the 90s. So, I mean, this is Triple H kind of early into his career before he's really started paying attention to becoming a real student of the craft.
Yeah.
And Mick Foley's Mick Foley. I'm not expecting a 5-star banger out of him, but he's going to hit his spot. So,
for sure. And look, they had better matches, you know, over the next 5 years, these guys, but some of their matches in 97 were better too. They had a match, I think the prior month here, which was the Canadian Stampede, was much better. In terms of the storyline, it was big for Mick because he was going through that babyface turn where he was developing into that Dude Love character and making him very likable. Because after this match was over, he's laying on the ground and the Dude Love music hits. And he starts tapping his feet as he's like basically knocked out. He gets up and he's like half Cactus Jack, half Dude Love.
The one thing I always, which always made me laugh with this match, was that he was supposed to rip off his shirt and was supposed to have like the heart tattoo, but it clearly was just painted on and it just sweated off in the match.
Yeah,
it's like oh, that heart tattoo. I'm like, are you sure?
Yeah. I mean, for those of you who
looks like a well,
for those of you who probably don't know, there was a spot in the match where Mankind or Mick was trying to get out of the cage and China literally threw the cage door at the skull of Mick Foley. And Mick has gone on record a couple times saying that she laid that shit in. Like, that was a smack, and like Mick Foley said it, you know, he felt like he was knocked out for a few seconds. But if anybody wants to go back and check that out, it's like in the middle of the match. Oh my god, like you could hear it, you heard it.
That was the old blue cage
too. Yeah, Unforgiving.
That wasn't like it was chain link like it is today. I mean, there was no give on that.
Yeah.
Like when they say steel cage, they meant legit steel cage.
Yeah. In the words of Jim Ross, that cage door showed no surcease in its attack on Mick Foley.
Thank you, Jim Ross.
Surcease. You're welcome. Sassafras. They bring out the governor of New Jersey, Christy Todd Weber.
Todd Whitman.
Whitman, sorry, I don't know why I wrote Weber. Who gets booed by most of the crowd. Basically,
sounds about right.
Yeah, she allowed this show to take place because the WWF had been out of New Jersey for about 7 or 8 years at this point, due to some tax issues. Because I think at this time, New Jersey was taxing and sporting teams. But the thing is that WWE was trying to say all along is, we're not boxing. We're sports entertainment. We're not a sporting event. So Christy Whitman finally was the one to come in New Jersey and cut the entertainment, the sporting tax out. And then here we go. We have a pay-per-view in New Jersey. Second match here is Brian Pillman versus Goldust with Marlena. If Brian Pillman lost, he would have to wear a dress, I think, the next night on Raw. The winner via pinfall at 7 minutes and 15 seconds was Goldust. I mean, this was a bad match, and I didn't want it to be because you could just tell that Brian Pillman's injuries have just limited him immensely for what he can do in the ring. His offense was just so weak, and I got to give credit to Goldust or, you know, Dustin Rhodes here. He did everything he could to make it work, but it just didn't work at all. But the crowd was mostly into it, even though they recognized it was a very botched finish. But it just sucked to see Pillman's body was breaking down. He passed away 2 months after this match.
It was exactly 2 months later.
Exactly 2 months, yeah. God, he was such a great performer when his mind was right and he had developed such a great character. Can you imagine if he never gotten hurt, that, you know, that ankle injury? And can you imagine a sane-minded Brian Pillman in the heat of the Attitude Era, that loose cannon character?
Oh my God.
He would have been incredible. For those of you listening who don't know much about Brian Pillman, just look him up. Look up Hollywood Blondes with him in Austin and WCW. And look up his singles matches in WCW. Brian Pillman was the shit in the early 90s, mid-90s. He was spectacular. Post-match, Pillman beats up a mannequin and rips up the dress because he had to wear it the next night, on Raw. Now we go into another shit show. Legion of Doom versus the Godwins. Hey, hey. This isn't Legion. I'll get to it. It's not. I don't blame Legion. I don't blame Legion of Doom. At 9:50.
Did you notice the botch at the very beginning of the match?
Oh my God!
When Animal threw Fat Godwin number one into the ropes, and he just kind of like, just like backed up into the ropes.
Yep.
Godwin was terrible.
You could tell during parts of this match that LOD were stiff with the Godwins. It was a very formulaic, I give it half a star. It was a very formulaic tag team match for the most part. LOD started off real hot. Then, unfortunately, the Godwins slowed it down. Hawk got a great hot tag, and that was the end of the match. Everybody, you know, I thought worked hard. The crowd, as always, forever, loved LOD. So that worked well.
Animal had that great Mohawk mullet.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. You know, I love the Legion of Doom and their look and their star power. But the matches in WWE at this point were like rarely good. You know, I felt like they always gave them not the best workers to work with. The Godwins were never that good. I mean, they sucked, to be honest. But I barely remembered this match. And I just don't have a desire to watch it again after Legion of Doom makes their entrance.
The tag division was so bad in 97.
So bad. Yeah, right.
Like, you can tell it's bad because your tag team champions were Stone Cold and Mankind.
Exactly.
Well, let's not beat around the bush. WWE has always been very hit and miss with the tag team division.
It has. You're right.
Always.
Yeah, but like 97, this was weak. I think LOD and the Goblins, I think, were the only tag teams that they had. So they're like, hey.
That's more than some other errors that they had. I mean, you know, what do they have really now? The Usos?
The Usos, the New Day, Viking Raiders. I mean, they have more
Viking tag Raiders. Get out of here with that. might as well bring up Ascension.
Yes. what was even not funny, but in a bad way, the finish was a spike pile driver finish on a guy that broke his neck months earlier. So you won't see that in the WWE again, I'll tell you that.
It seems like
the last time we see a
pile driver. Yeah.
It was like Animal and Hulk got pissed off at the Goblins for being awful wrestlers, and they were like, fuck it, let's break his neck.
Yeah. Oh man. there are $2 million chance finalists standing with Todd Pettengill as well as Sable and Sonny. Let me just say
this is gonna be about boobs.
1997, Sable and Sonny. I'm not sure they can be rivaled, to be honest with you. I mean, Sable was incredible in 1997. Did you guys watch the segment?
Unfortunately.
It was an awful segment. Yeah. I mean, I felt so bad for Todd Pettengill because it was so uncomfortable. People now wonder why most things are scripted. That's why.
Todd Pettengill, at one point when he was waiting for someone to pick up the phone, like clearly and obviously stared down at Sonny's tits.
Oh, it was great. There was a point when I think Sonny hugged the 12-year-old boy, and Todd Pettengill said, "Trust me, man, eventually you'll realize that was worth way more than $1 million. I was like, my man, Todd, good for you. So yeah, that was, you know, about 7 minutes, which was a massive time waster. Just uncomfortable you can to watch.
You could say you got hugged by Sunny when she was the hottest woman on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not hugged by Sunny, and by hugged by Sunny, I mean destroyed by her car in Florida and dead. Oh, is that too much? You draw the line
no,
there?
No, I don't draw the line there. She deserves it. Next up, European title. British Bulldog is the incumbent champion here versus Ken Shamrock.
Proper Bulldog with the English national anthem and
yep.
and fringe. Not blue jeans and dogs barking in the background.
Blue jeans tucked into boots and dogs barking. Best yep. era of Bulldog.
1999 Bulldog comes back to the company and says, "Oh, I want a challenge for the title," and he's then feuding with Bossman.
It's a title.
Yeah. Bulldog gets the win via disqualification. I actually thought this was a decent match with Bulldog on the offense for the majority of it. I thought he went for the rest holds way too much, although I think that's basically because, one, Shamrock hadn't had many matches under his belt by this point, but you could tell there were certain times where Shamrock was on the verge of blowing up, and the veteran Bulldog was like, all right, let's hop into a rest hold real quick. The key thing here to me was the post-match angle, which worked really well. Much like earlier matches on the show, the angle was much more important than the match. Dude, the pop for Shamrock after this match was one of the biggest pops of the night. I thought Shamrock was one of those lost like treasures that of who what could have been in the WWF if he really gave it like his all, because he was always over and he brought serious legitimacy to the product. And he was just a legit badass.
Chris, I got a question for you.
Sure, go ahead.
Do you happen to know a reason why he has basically never, ever, ever, ever returned to the company in any fashion in almost 25 years?
Well, I know for a long time he just flat out didn't want to go back. But now I know over the last couple of years he's, I don't want to use the word begging, but he's basically been saying, I want to be in the Hall of Fame.
He should be.
Truthfully. Yeah, I agree.
He's a massive part of the Attitude Era.
I don't know why he hasn't come back. There's got to be a reason because everybody comes back. So yeah. It's
Warrior came back.
I know Warrior came back. Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe I'll do some digging online about it. But there was a point in this match. The one thing I do remember about this match is there was a point where they were on the outside, and there were steel steps. And
they bossed the suplex
because I think Bulldog did not know the steps were there. And when he went to get him up, Shamrock Penguin said, "Oh no, this ain't happening." Like just went straight to the ground. And yeah. Shamrock had the wherewithal.
Or Shamrock was dead weight, but I think Bulldog could have lifted him if he was dead weight.
Yeah.
Bulldog
probably.
Was a mammoth dude for just only being like 5'10", 5'11". He was so strong and jacked. Yeah. He was pretty lean here though. He had some pretty good leanness to him.
Yeah. He looked good here. He looked great. Backstage, Todd Pettengill talks to the ref of the main event, Shawn Michaels. He says he's going to be an impartial, unbiased, fair referee, that nothing will get past the keen eye of Shawn Michaels, he says.
He also botched that promo.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. That's because he probably had about four somas going.
He's like nothing to get past the lazy eye of Shawn Michaels.
Wow.
It
took me off guard, though, because Shawn doesn't usually – mess up a promo.
No.
So when he did, I was taken aback by it. I was like, oh my.
It was like a one word little stutter. Like,
but even that though, he is just so good on the mic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just it took me off guard. I was like, wow, that's something I'd be like Bret Hart making a mistake in the ring.
Oh, exactly. It doesn't happen often at all.
Pre super kicked in the head.
Pre Goldberg. Next match is Los Boricuas, Savio Vega, Miguel Perez, Jesus Castillo, and Jose Estrada. So everyone is meaningless except Savio Vega. Yeah, you should have.
George was like, I'm not watching this, and he skipped the next one.
It was just flat out just ugly to watch this match. It was just bad.
Bowling shoe ugly.
Bowling shoe ugly. So yeah, it's just terrible. By the way, Los Barriques was one. They gave this match 9 minutes. We get a video package hyping up the Owen Hart, Steve Austin match, the IC title. This was built up from the previous month where Owen pinned Austin in a 10-man main event at Canadian Stampede. The stipulation is that if Austin can't win a title, he has to kiss Owen's ass. Intercontinental title match, here we go. Owen Hart, the incumbent champion versus Steve Austin, the winner by pinfall, I guess. And your new IC champion, Steve Austin, at 16 minutes and 15 seconds. So while everybody remembers the spike pile driver at the end, you take out that last 2.5, 3 minutes. This is a 4-star match. It was tremendous up until the unfortunate, you know, accident that took place. You know, they did a great job of telling a story in this match with Owen working over the neck while Austin kept on fighting as best as he could. It really got over their characters with Owen being so technical while Austin was that brawler who, like always, just never quit. There probably was another 5 minutes or so that was going to take place that obviously didn't happen, but what they did was still great. You know, you have to credit both guys for doing this job, especially after the injury. You know, what was your thoughts, guys, looking back at this like 25 years later?
At one point, on commentary, Vince said it's like Owen has a bullseye on Austin's neck. And I'm like, well, this isn't going to age well in 5 minutes.
Not, it does not.
It was a great match right up until the very end.
Yeah.
So I really don't have anything negative to say. It was a freak accident that despite the fact that it did take Austin out, he was still showing up on TV on a pretty.
Oh yeah. Which was great because he was cutting promos and building up that character. It was almost a blessing in disguise in a way. So in Austin's book, he talked about how before the match, they went over how it would go. And for the spot, Austin insisted that he drop to his knees for it. And I remember Austin on his podcast say, like, you're going to drop to your knees, right? And Owen laughed and he says, no, I'm going to drop to my ass. And then Owen said it. And then Austin said, no, you're going to drop to your knees, right? And then Owen laughed it off and said, no, I'm going to drop to my ass. And then Austin, naturally knowing the famous ribber that Owen was, he just thought, oh, okay, he'll drop to his knees. No big deal. Well, that didn't happen because, you know, Austin felt safe enough with Owen to trust him because, you know, Owen always had the reputation for being a great worker. Plus, Austin has an immense amount of respect for the Hart family. But, you know, I can't blame Austin for trusting him. You know, apparently the story was for Owen to continue to work on the neck, hence JR, like you guys said, mentioning the sore neck. And then Austin would end up winning with a stunner out of nowhere. You know, they put over the strength of the stunner, even though Austin did eventually go on to become one of the biggest, you know, stars ever, if not the biggest. His career was shortened because of this night. And that's why this is such a historic match for all the wrong reasons. And, you know, Owen's an asshole for never calling Austin and asking if he was okay or apologizing. You know, Austin said he never got a phone call. Owen never brought it up again. And it's just like, you know, fuck you, dude.
Well, I think we know why he didn't bring it up again.
Well, I mean, that was like 2 years later.
He was sitting there, he's like, you know, day after over the edge, I'm going to mend the fences.
Oh, yep. Let's talk after the match tonight, Steve. All right. Well, sorry.
He's like, ah, damn it, he got me again.
damn it. It all fell through. I didn't mean to say it like that.
Technically, I would say Owen did get a stunner. He got a stunner from a post to his face.
Okay. Oh, my dear Lord. So because of...
I kid. I love that one.
So because of you know, this night, you know, we lost Austin's career after 2003 at 38 years old. So it was just...
I mean, to be fair, for a guy, he had been in the business, you know, pushing two decades at that point. You know what I mean? I think he debuted in WCW in, like, 94? 89, yeah. So, I mean...
He was rookie of the year, I think, in 89 or 90.
Yeah, that's right. So, like, you know, if it wasn't his knee, if it wasn't his neck that was going to give out on him, it was going to be his knees. But hey, you know what? It gave us that amazing match at WrestleMania.
It did. You're right. I agree. All right. We're going to take a quick break because we're getting to the main event here, and then we'll wrap things up quickly on the other side. At Hot Tag Podcast on Instagram, you guys can check out all the updates on the show. All right. On the other side, we're going to wrap this up. We have main event time coming. Bret Hart versus The Undertaker for the WWF World title. I'm Chrissy Francesco. That's Dean and George. We'll be right back in just a few seconds. So wait for us. Welcome back, Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast, 1997 SummerSlam from East Rutherford, New Jersey. We are at the main event, World Heavyweight title, the incumbent champion, The Undertaker versus Bret the Hitman Hart, with your special guest referee, Shawn Michaels. Bret Hart pins The Undertaker and is your fifth time WWF champion at 28 minutes.
Final time.
That's correct. Yeah. Man, this is crazy. Each guy here, you know, Michael's got a full on entrance, a full HBK entrance. So after this match, man, you know, Michaels quickly bails to the floor after it's over, pissed off about what happened. The crowd is buzzing at this point, booing the absolute hell out of Bret Hart and throwing garbage in the ring. Undertaker stumbles his way up the aisle while Hart poses with the title that he's won for a fifth time. Look, I wish this match was like about 20 minutes instead of nearly 30, but I still give it about 3.5 stars, 4 stars. Because I think if this match was 20 minutes instead of nearly 30, it would have been better in terms of quality, because there were times when it seemed to kind of really drag on. My guess is that they were supposed to go 5 minutes less, but they had to go longer because the Owen Austin match ended earlier than expected. But, you know, that's just me. You know, I'm freestyling on that one. I really thought Bret was absolutely tremendous in this match. And he, and I honestly believe Bret was incredible on camera the entire year of 1997 up to the Montreal Screwjob. He did all the heel tricks that you could do, like cheap attacks, you know, blatant cheating, outsmarting a baby face, you know, both of them in the match, actually. Undertaker did his job well, too, although, you know, he was the one that was on the defensive for most of it, which was odd. So a lot of his offense wasn't even, you know, present in this match. But the story I thought was good. It was there. You know, it's not a 4 or 5 star match, but it really was one of the best angles the company did that year. And it led to greater things in the future that we'll eventually cover down the line. But I still can't shake this feeling, guys. And maybe you disagree. I still can't shake this feeling that in the 90s, Undertaker was such a disrespected transitional champion. Every time he had the championship belt, I thought they never really gave him like that Bret Hart run or that really good, I don't want to say Hulk run, but maybe even like a Macho Man run, where let him have it for like a year and be that dominant big man. I don't know if he's the kind of guy that doesn't need the title to be over, which he doesn't. But when you're in the 90s here and his character is so Teflon, I just felt like they really just kind of was really blah with his title run. What do you guys think?
I completely agree. And I think especially like in this era, because I think this was a transitional character for him for a little bit, because like this is like I pointed out that weird cowboy hat he had in the promo picture. Yes. And it was you know, there was the transition of like, you know, the Western Undertaker, you know, coming out with the urn and the tie and stuff like that, to like the Lord of Darkness, you know what I mean? So this is like a weird kind of phase for him. Like, but I agree. Like, I don't really think his correct me if I'm wrong, George, did he hold the title when he was the head of the Ministry of Darkness?
Yes.
Okay. I couldn't remember, but I see, look, that there's a title reign. I don't remember. But I feel like it wasn't until he became the American Badass when he started to have more like a respected run. And then of course, when he came back as, you know, The Undertaker, you know, when he came in 2004 was when he had a, you know, a really good, respectable run or two. For a while when he, you know, leading up to that last title defense, you know, title reign he had. But I completely agree. Like, what was his first title, man?
He beat Hogan.
He beat Hogan in Survivor Series, wasn't that? And then he dropped it, what was it, like a month later, Tuesday night in Texas, something like that? You know, in a roll-up. Hogan beat him in a roll-up, you know? So, I totally agree.
Yeah. George.
To kind of talk about like his first title run was I almost feel like that was just the company trying to test the waters and see, you know, what kind of reaction he was going to get from the crowd as a champ, you know, going over Hogan. But obviously Hogan took one look at that, stroked his goatee, and he's like, that doesn't work for me, brother. I want that belt. So he got the belt back, and then it was 6 years before he got the title again.
And,
I mean, you guys know everything leading up to this pay-per-view with, or leading up to WrestleMania 13, where, you know, Michaels lost his smile and relinquished the belt. So basically them throwing the title on Taker was almost like a last ditch. Like, we need to put this belt on somebody and it can't be Bret or Austin because they're feuding together. Like, it was the safe bet to put it on. And they must have known that this was going to be a temporary thing. It's like, all right, we're going to give this to you, but you're going to lose it to Bret.
And
So it's a shame, really.
Yeah.
That they didn't at least give him a feud with Diesel for the belt, because Diesel's title run was fucking shit on toast. I mean, you
know, he beat Sid for the title, right? At WrestleMania 13, correct?
Yeah.
Or 12? 12, 13? 13. Yeah. So.
Because 12 was the Iron Man match.
Correct.
But
wait, what Iron Man match? Oh, yeah. Shawn Michaels and Bret, yeah. For some reason, I used the Iron Man match, and I thought of the match between Bam Bam and Lawrence Taylor at WrestleMania 11.
That wasn't going an hour.
No.
But they always stuck Taker in these, like, bullshit, you know, he's feuding with the Million Dollar Corporation. It's like, why?
Yeah.
They fucking, it's like, oh, he's going to face Kama and Ken Kong Bundy. It's like, okay. Enjoy all of that. I mean, then even when he got the belt in 99, and Dean, the main reason why you don't remember is because it wasn't priority. Like, it didn't matter who had the title, essentially, because it was, you know, ministry versus corporation. Then it was corporate ministry versus union. Then it was all a ruse to, you know, to keep Austin from having the title. Like he won the belt. It was over the edge. It was over the edge. Because they had the two referees. It was Vince and Shane, and both those referees. It was a convoluted shit show.
Yeah.
But I mean, he had a small run, but he had one defense against The Rock at King of the Ring, and then immediately lost the belt the next night after King of the Ring to Austin.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like there was just, he could have had a longer run, but how much of a long run is he really going to have if he's the leader of the Ministry of Darkness or the corporate ministry?
Right.
Good point.
Yeah.
I'm also not trying to defend, you know, the company's poor decisions, but
yeah,
I feel like just like for his 97 run alone, I feel like it was just, all right, we need someone to hold the belt, and he was the safe bet.
I agree.
He was probably also the only former champion that they had on staff.
Yeah. I thought the finish was great. Hart accidentally helped Michaels, was actually being helped by Michaels, which is a great story. And then it led, you know, to awesome feud with Undertaker that produced, you know, one of my top two favorite matches ever, which was Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood in October. Post-match, the other Hart Foundation members come into the ring to celebrate with Hart. It really was, you know, a great America versus the world angle. And a lot of people, you know, that were watching in those days, you know, were really happy with this. You know, this was a hot angle with Brett. And, you know, the show ends with the Hart Foundation walking up the aisle, you know, with the just massive boos from the crowd. So, you know, that's Finn. That's the end of the pay-per-view. Look, you know, the next couple months in this company are some of the most, the most storied events in the history of pro wrestling, yeah, with the Hell in a Cell in October. And then you got the Montreal Screwjob in November.
And Michaels
getting hurt in January. Then the Austin era. And yeah, it's like incredible that from August of 97, and then you fast forward to March of 98, mm-hmm, it's a rocket, yeah, this company, it's incredible.
It's crazy to think that come March, both Hart and Michaels are out of the company.
Yeah. Yep.
It's, you know, these were guys who had been there for a decade.
Yeah.
Hart longer.
Longer. You
know,
yeah.
But like, these are two mainstays of the company, you know, mm-hmm, came in same, similar situations, both tag teams, you know, Hart Foundation, one of the best ever. Mm-hmm. Rockers, I'll put them up there too. I mean, for not technically being champions ever in the company. But like, just to think about the fact that, like, think about our age too. That was 1998 come March, you know, and when last time we see Sean as an in-ring performer for 4 years, think about, you know, I am 11 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, you're probably 12. Yes.
I was turning.
You're turning 12.
Turning 11 in 97.
Well, I'm talking about in WrestleMania 98.
Oh, yeah, I was 12.
And then George, you're what, 13? So, you know, to think about, you know, these are guys that we had grown up watching, mm-hmm, you know, and probably fans of both. I mean, you're not supposed to be. You know, that was the rivalry, you know, Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels. But I love both guys.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch them both leave the company, you know, be out of the company, it's just a crazy feeling to think about the fact that, you know, the ringmaster and, mm-hmm, then, you know, Hunter Hearst Helmsley became the faces of WWF.
And then Rocky yeah, Maivia.
Flex Cavana.
So for me,
Terror Rising, and Flex Cavana were the faces of the company.
Oh my God. For me, the three stars of the night for me were Brett, Austin, and Mankind. Overall, out of a 10, I gave this show a 5, which is right around average. I thought the main event was super historic and is one of those matches that I would always recommend people to go watch if you haven't done so already. And then Hart Austin match was looking like a classic up until the neck injury. But again, it's something that you should see because it's one of those most, you know, pivotal moments in the trajectory of one of the greatest stars in the history of the company of wrestling. So definitely, you know, go do that. Do not go watch the 8-man tag because that was downright awful. But just saying overall, if you take out those two matches, it's one of the most forgettable SummerSlams of all time. What did you guys think? I'll start with you, George.
If it's not for those two matches, it's easily like Get In Your House.
Agreed. Yeah. How about you? What do you rate it, George?
I'm with you on 5. I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. Because those two matches were so good, and for basically what this pay-per-view kicked off for everybody, for Austin, for Taker, HBK,
yeah, Brett,
like everyone, you know, it turned into, you know, it was basically, this pay-per-view was a catalyst for the Attitude Era, just because of where everybody went. Like, there's a lot of significance with this pay-per-view.
Yeah. Joe Dean.
I'm right with you. A 5 out of 10. The Owen and Austin match, you know, outside of the, you know, the obviously the botched move and shitty ending. It was a really good match. Again, that's what you expect of Owen Hart and Steve Austin, you know, two absolute generals of the ring. The main event, I missed the main event today, but I do remember the main event. It was, you know, it was a decent match. Nothing, you know, again, two clash styles clashes with, you know, arguably the greatest technical wrestler in the history of the game, against, you know, a big man. You know, I mean, it's hard for, I mean, listen, Taker's the right big man to go with, but it's still a styles clash, and not much of the rest of the pay-per-view I was really enamored with. So, but I agree with George too. Like, this really feels like it's like, it was slowly building, you know, obviously with the feud with Michaels and Brett, but like, this really was like leading to essentially Survivor Series. Like, this was that next pivotal step, you know, to Survivor Series.
I mean, agree.
They even promoted the one night only pay-per-view that was coming up with there, where they talked about Shawn Michaels versus the British Bulldog.
Yeah, you're right.
And we knew what happened in that match. So clearly, like, the Michaels heel turn was, I mean, knowing what we know of the future, like, it's right there.
I know. Like, yep. You're right. All right. So that wraps up SummerSlam 1997. Next week, we're going to be covering SummerSlam 1999. Very much looking forward to that one. This was at a point where the company was never, ever bigger than it had been. Nothing in the golden age, nothing, you know, before this or after. This is the hottest time in the company.
What year did you say?
1999.
Right, that's what I thought you said. Okay.
Yeah, in terms of like, go ahead.
I'll say 99 for me, just on a personal standpoint, this is where I changed the channel from WCW and never went back.
I agree. That was where I was as well. Well, once Austin became champion and then McMahon got involved, I was done with WCW.
I wasn't done with WCW, but I was tuning in. Like, I'd watch that first hour again. We had eight to nine was unrivaled.
Right.
And it was pretty much like 9 o'clock came on, Raw came on, and it was just like, I might turn back around like 9:50 to see the main event for Nitro. But other than that, it was just, why am I turning back?
Agreed. Yeah, I agree.
I set the remote down and never picked it back up.
I agree. All right, guys, thank you very much for hopping on here. Looking forward to next week, 1999 SummerSlam. Cannot wait. And then again, from 1999, then we're going to talk about 2005, which is one of my favorite pay-per-views ever. I can't wait to talk about the brother getting brothered by HBK. So that I can't wait.
That's
for that.
Not going to work for me, brother.
It's
brother. What you going to do, brother?
That's all right. I'll just make you look like an idiot in the middle of the ring. Hey, so
who's the greatest of all time?
That'd be Shawn Michaels. and that match just proved it to me. Like, everyone always goes, why does Shawn Michaels do it? Because he can, and he did. Yeah. Because he's not gonna get fired. He's untouchable.
He was untouchable.
He even said it in the promo against Hogan. He goes, "You can't touch me," and it's like the most assholish yet truthful thing you could say to somebody. If you're Shawn, it's like, none of you can't touch me. I'll do whatever I want to do, and I'll still make you look great. And he made that match. He made Hogan even look great in that match.
The issue was, you had Shawn, who is probably the greatest, like, just natural performer ever in the business. Mm-hmm. But like, if only it could have been like 87 to 88 Hogan versus like 05 Michaels, which I actually think, even though he didn't hold many titles after his return, his second half of his career might even have been better than his first half.
Shawn,
yeah.
Well, I that's what I feel. I think he's got that second act made him that's the greatest I've ever seen anyone ever.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only person that might come close is whatever Orton does in his second act. If he wraps things up, if they treat it correctly, I think he can have that second act that's untouchable. So we'll see what happens there.
Could you imagine, like, you know, take your vitamins and say your prayers, Hogan, pinnacle, you know, bandana with the tassels in front of his face, you know.
Yep.
Roided up.
You know, against, you know, 05 heel Michaels, because that heel Michaels for this, I can't wait.
I can't wait to cover that whole thing. Yes.
So good, man.
Yeah.
You know,
and we're going to cover the, you know, all the promos that led up to that as well.
Yeah, I feel like if heel 05 HBK was facing 87, 88 Hogan, he would have been like, yeah, take all those vitamins you've been taking. They're all anabolic, right?
But actually, on the inverse, too, could you imagine if this would have been like prime Hollywood Hogan versus like a face Michaels?
Mm-hmm.
Because then on the inverse, Hogan could have been like, well, you never drew a dime, brother. You know, company almost went out of business with you as champion. You know, this, that, and the other. That also would have been really good, too.
It's a good point. All right, boys, thank you very much. This is a wrap on SummerSlam 1997. We'll see you guys back here next week for SummerSlam 1999, smack dab in the middle of the Attitude Era. Cannot wait. So, for
Tom Zink on this one?
Yes, he's the main event.
Finally.
For Dean and George, I'm Chris DeFrancesco, and we'll catch you guys down the road. Have a great rest of your week and weekend. Bye-bye.